This is The Guardian.
Wer die Finanzen eines Unternehmens managt, ist oft beschäftigt. Sehr beschäftigt. Sehr, sehr, sehr beschäftigt. Konto ist das All-in-One-Geschäftskonto, um Ihr Unternehmen zu managen. Egal, ob Sie selbstständig sind oder die Finanzabteilung eines mittleren Unternehmens leiten. Mit Konto erledigen Sie alles in einer App. Geschäftskonto schnell eröffnen? Erledigt. Ausgabenmanagement? Erledigt. Buchhaltung und Reporting? Erledigt. Konto. Das Geschäftskonto, das zu Ihnen passt.
Trust Liz, the Conservative Party candidate, 11,217.
We're going down like ninepins, and that is the conclusion of this evening.
I will shortly be seeing His Majesty the King to offer my resignation as Prime Minister.
What an amazing reception. We did it!
Laura, I'm fed up with performance art politics. I've watched colleagues in the Conservative Party strike poses, write inflammatory op-eds.
And there is only one thing that I can say. Sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry that my party didn't listen to you.
Jeremy Bernard Corbyn, commonly known as Jeremy Corbyn, independent, 24,000.
Preparation for the House of Commons, I suppose, isn't it?
I'm John Harris.
I'm Pippa Creera.
And I'm Kieran Stacey.
And on the day after the general election and at the start of, and I'll say this slowly, a brand new Labour government, you are listening to Politics Weekly UK for The Guardian. Right, here's a question. In my script here, it says, how does everyone feel? Extremely tired to the point that everything's a bit psychedelic is my immediate answer. But there is a political aspect to this, I suppose. How do you both feel? Tell me.
Well, I think I probably have to say also that I'm absolutely knackered. I managed to stay up to see Liz Truss lose her seat in what will now be known as elections going forward as the Truss moment rather than the Portillo moment.
That's hardcore because that what was about 6?
It is about 6:45 by the time I think my eyes finally closed, and then I had a couple of hours of kip and got up again. But I've been kept fueled by huge amounts of cupcakes and pizza and coffee.
Caffeine,
and,
so much caffeine. Yeah. I feel like my hands are shaking and I'm starting to see funny colours.
But emotionally, it's interesting, isn't it? Because we haven't had a Labour government for so long, and certainly the election of a new one. I was 27 when that happened. I'm now exactly twice that age. That shows you how long ago it was. Even my cynical friends are on social media talking about welling up at Keir Starmer's speech on the outside the door of Downing Street. And I'm thinking, oh, yeah, I remember these. Mm. This is a honeymoon period. It's sort of fascinating and quite kind of disorientating, isn't it?
It is. Although, I mean, I'm quite good at separating out my sort of professional self from my personal self. And my professional self can see that this is a massive story, this huge Labour landslide and all this other stuff that's happened with these other parties as well, and finds it fascinating and exciting and exhilarating. And the personal bit of me actually just probably needs to go and like sit in a quiet room for 5 minutes and contemplate what it all means. Because I've got three children, one of whom was born in 2009 and the others who were born under a Conservative government, and they've lived most of their lives under Conservative government. Yeah. And I've not seen them yet since the election because obviously we were working all night, still working here at Westminster in the office, bit of hubbub in the background. And it won't be till later tonight till I get home and actually we'll be able to try and, you know, share with them what a big moment this is. I mean, they'll probably just tell me to go away and they're gaming or reading books or, you know, want their tea. But even so, I'm going to try and persuade them that this is a big moment.
My daughter was born in 2009, my youngest child. And I phoned her the day of the election and I said, this is a really big deal, you know. You really got to kind of drink this in. Because I mean, I have, you know, memories of those Thatcher elections in the 80s. You know, they're very sort of vivid moments, not necessarily in a good way. This has that sort of rosy glow about it.
I think there's two things competing. One is people coming to terms with the actual numbers underlying what happened last night. So, yeah, it's a huge landslide, but the vote share is not that great. And this doesn't feel like some kind of massive mandate for an incoming government, like the whole country's united behind them. So kind of picking up on the mood of the Labour Party, I think there's a little bit of tentativeness there. It's not it's certainly not as celebratory as it was in 1997. You just had to watch that rally on Friday morning with Kit.
What's going on there?
Does John Creese, our sketch writer, ripping pages out of his notebook? I'm not quite sure
In disgust.
He's obviously not impressed by his first draft
he's
of his copy.
He's making schoolroom type paper pellets to throw
to
at Nigel
Farage. To chuck
at
us, paper aeroplanes at Nigel Farage, exactly.
But yeah, so
anyway, carry on, Kieran.
Well,
sorry.
If you compare the rally in 1997, which Tony Blair went to on the morning after the election over at the South Bank, where he said a new dawn has broken, has it? No, and it just, you know, it obviously felt like this huge moment of national unity. And that is not how it feels here today. And I don't think any Labour person is kidding themselves that that's the mood of the country. But at the same time, while that might be the national mood, the reality is you've got a government now with a majority large enough to do whatever it wants for 5 years. And that is astonishing after the period of chaos we've had, now to essentially have the prospect of a government that can get its teeth stuck into anything that it wants to do and have the time to do it. I think that's going to take some kind of psychological adjustment for a lot of people here in Westminster.
Let's just go through the numbers for those who don't know. The Labour Party has 412 seats in the House of Commons. The Conservatives have 121. The Lib Dems are on 71, which is that of itself is worthy of comment. Reform have 4. The Greens have 4, up from 1. The SNP has 10. We'll come on to a lot of these things in a minute. And Plaid Cymru has 4. Let's talk about the Labour Party. The Labour Party, as Kieran has mentioned, has a landslide in seats but not votes. The Labour Party's share of the vote came in at about 35%, which is not dissimilar from what Jeremy Corbyn got in 2019.
Yeah, and much less than he got in 2017.
Yeah, Tony Blair in 2005 got about 35%. Ed Miliband, anyone remember in 2015?
Well, he had the 35% strategy, didn't he?
Yeah.
That was what he was aiming for.
And turnout was low at 60%. That's just worth alighting on briefly and to maybe speculate a bit about what happened there. The election was presented to the public somewhat as a wholly foregone conclusion. And a lot of people talked about less than subtle voter suppression. Do you think that was a factor?
I think that was the Conservatives' intention when they adopted this supermajority line, this warning that Labour could walk into a majority so big that the Conservative Party was left with double figures and nobody really to hold it properly to account in the House of Commons. And, you know, that probably did have a degree of impact in the same way that in 2017, lots of Labour MPs went out on the doorstep and said, you can vote for me even if you don't like Jeremy Corbyn, because it's really important that there's a proper opposition to the Conservatives because they're bound to win. And then obviously it ended up being hung Parliament. So I think that probably did have a bit of an impact. But I think lower turnout more generally is about how people feel about politics and not just about individual politicians, but about the political system and how that sort of that bond, that link between people and Westminster has been degraded over many years. And this is not a new phenomenon, but it obviously escalated hugely under Boris Johnson, with him sort of like, you know, ripping up conventions and breaking rules. And, you know, we've all rehearsed this countless times. And then the big broken promises, you know, big promises on Brexit, big promises on levelling up, big promises that people's lives would be better and that they would not just feel better off, but they would feel better about their country, they would feel better represented. And yet we're at a point now, after everything that's happened in the last 14 years, where people just don't feel that. And that sort of disengagement, that disillusionment applies right across the political spectrum. And I think, frankly, a lot of people just thought, you know what, they're all the same. It's not going to make any difference to my life. I'm not going to vote.
Yeah, they're very cliched conversations and they can wear you down. But I have to say, having travelled around the country now for 5 weeks, spending a great deal of the time talking to voters or non-voters, there was a great deluge of that stuff. To the point it felt a bit like a sort of collective allergy. It wasn't just kind of a sign disconnection. It was tinged with a sort of bitterness and a resentment. And that then blurs into the vote for reform, among other people, to my mind. You know, that was the sort of anti-politics vote, which they definitely exploited. It was a big, big theme, that mood, particularly in England, actually.
Yeah, and I think this is where the Tories are getting it slightly wrong, where they keep telling reform voters, oh, you should vote for us because that's the only way you don't get Keir Starmer. I think a lot of these reform voters don't care. The point is not to get a right-wing government. The point is that I'm saying none of the above, thank you very much. And would you please listen to me when I say that? And until the Tories realise that that's the message they're getting, not that there's some kind of right-wing, you know, vote that can be reunified, because there's not. That's not what the voters are telling us.
Yeah, it's a bit, it's sort of nihilistic, at least some of the reform vote, isn't it? It's just like throw the monopoly board in the air and see
who
cares.
I mean, you know, it's the Brexit vote. To a large extent, isn't it? And actually, if you look at the reform numbers, they're quite similar to the UKIP numbers in 2015. In fact, they're very similar. Vote share is very similar. They won a few more seats. They've come second in about, you know, in a very similar number of seats.
Just over 100, I think, reform.
Just over 100, 103, I think it was. So, you know, they are the same force, I think, that UKIP was in 2015. And, of course, UKIP in 2015 helped put the Tory position in a position where we ended up with Brexit. So,
yeah, you say that, but also in some of those sort of post-industrial so-called red wall seats, reform strikes me as being in the same position that the Tories were in 2017. Do you remember when the Labour vote started to go to the Tories in 2017, and no one really noticed, and it sort of and the Tories came second in a lot of those sort of ex-coalfield seats, for example, and it set the stage for 2019. And in that sense, I suppose the Labour people who are worried about reform might look ahead to the next election and say, well, Christ, what's going to happen next?
Well, they already are. I mean, we've been having conversations with people like, you know, Morgan McSweeney, who's the campaign director and will have a sort of big political job in Downing Street, we expect, and others around Keir Starmer, politicians too, about what they do about the populist right more broadly. Now, this is obviously something most urgently that they're concerned about here in the UK, but it is also a phenomenon that we're seeing replicated right across Europe, particularly in France and Poland and Germany. And as the year goes on, we'll also see it more across the Atlantic in the United States. And I think that when it comes to how they deal it with here, I spoke to Keir Starmer last week about this, and he said that actually it was about delivering. The best thing he can do is to try and restore hope and to try and sort of vanquish that rise of the populist right, is to try and deliver meaningful change to people's lives. And he told me a story about that Frank Dobson, who was his predecessor as an MP in his North London seat, had told him about campaigning in a block of flats and going up to the door and knocking on the door and speaking to this woman about, you know, I think it was global poverty or it was some sort of big international issue. And she said, did you come up in the lift? And the candidate said, yeah, I did. And she said, the woman said, well, it smells of piss. And the candidate said, well, yeah, it did. And the woman said, well, you're not going to fix that first. And the sort of the takeaway from that analogy, that story for Starmer, was that you need to deal with the small things that make a big difference to people's lives before you can kind of, you know, to convince them that change is possible, whether it's fly tipping in the front garden, whether it's, you know, antisocial behaviour, before you can convince them that actually you're going to make much more substantial, meaningful, transformational change. So that, I mean, that's, they're aware of it, they're alive to it.
Can I just add one thing to that, which is that I also
should point out that you're in a working, thriving office here, and everyone is grafting like hell.
They really are.
We're up against the deadline. We're in Westminster.
It's the sound of toil. anyway, exactly. Keir, carry on.
I then spoke to Keir Starmer a few days after Pippa did, and he asked him the same question just to see whether he'd kind of thought any more about it. And he gave largely the same answer, but he did add one other thing, which I thought was really, really telling, which is that he said, we have to work with other people to help defeat the reform threat. And to me, that suggested he was going to be much more willing to work across party boundaries. Now, how that might happen, I doubt, certainly in the near term, that's going to be anything like the alliances that we're seeing in France, where candidates are standing down to, you know, in favour of each other to try and keep out what used to be the Front National. But what it might mean is, I wonder whether on issues, for example, such as social care, whether Keir Starmer will now look, instead of trying to put the Tory party in a corner and really humiliate it in its moment of weakness, whether he might just reach across the political boundary and say, look, if we're going to fix this, we kind of have to do this together.
That's
otherwise, it's
really,
just not going to work.
That's a really, really interesting prospect, isn't it?
Yeah.
Let's talk about another aspect of politics being disrupted aside from reform. There were candidates, Muslim candidates by and large, standing largely but not wholly on platforms focused on Gaza, who in some places did pretty well. Now, I spent some time about 2 weeks ago in the constituency of Ladywood in Birmingham, Shabana Mahmood's seat, where Ahmed Yaqub, a very high-profile Muslim pro-Gaza candidate, ended up getting about 12,000 votes to her 15.5. So he did pretty well. Jess Phillips in Birmingham Yardley, I think, had a lead cut over a similar independent candidate to only 689 votes. Wes Streeting, now the health secretary, only won by 500 votes to an independent. And Jonathan Ashworth, who up until yesterday was the shadow paymaster general, he lost his seat.
Yeah, right? That was amazing.
Now, that was I thought that was fascinating to watch, because back in the Brexit period, for example, I started to sense the so-called red wall shaking and peeling away from the Labour Party, that traditional working-class post-industrial group of voters. Something similar started to happen in Scotland around the time of the referendum. These hitherto reasonably rock-solid parts of Labour's electoral base, right? And one of the last ones, really, that felt solid was Muslim voters in cities. And this election suggests there are big cracks there, right?
Yeah, I think, you know, look, there's a couple of things to say. One is we kind of hope, I think that's fair to say, we hope that Gaza is not the issue that it is today in 5 years' time. So it might be that we look back on this moment and just think, hey, that was a moment in history where Labour got its response to a really big global event wrong and paid the price, but that then flipped quickly back. But one of the things that was interesting to me is, just as you were saying, John, it was the MPs who held on and the MPs who didn't were not expected. So I was expecting Shabana Mahmood to come under severe pressure. I was expecting Roshanara Ali to come under huge pressure in Bethnal Green, and she did, but they both held on. Jonathan Ashworth, I don't think any of us had on our bingo cards as being vulnerable. And I don't know, but I wonder whether, because Jonathan Ashworth had this national campaign role and probably wasn't in his constituency as much, whether what it's shown us is that MPs who maybe, you know, weren't able to campaign and get out there and door knock and be as present as they might like in their constituency, they were the ones who got punished. And if so, whether that tells us that, you know, if Labour does want to hold on to those voters, as well as getting the national response to things like Gaza, right, it also just has to put in the hard yards, knocking on doors and going round in seats that it's kind of maybe taken for granted for a while.
That was very much the message that I saw in the West Midlands on the part of those independent candidates, was the Labour Party doesn't care about you. It's just right. The same as the Conservative Party, as well as Gaza. This was all woven through. Mm. We all know Birmingham City Council has gone bankrupt. Loads of stuff about Birmingham Council cuts. It's quite a populist sort of platform, because it was mixed up with messages about getting rid of Birmingham's ultra-low emissions
subsidies.
You know? Yeah. It was like they'd got a sort of ragbag of grievances, really, and they said, right, we're going to campaign hard on all of these. And the idea that Labour takes you for granted.
Yeah,
right?
One place we should mention, though, of course, where that didn't happen. Well, the campaign happened very much along the lines that you mentioned, which, of course, was Rochdale, where George Gallery was elected in just a few months ago in a by-election and was up against Paul War, formerly of this parish. Yeah, I used to work with him back in the Evening Standard, who he was from Rochdale originally and went back up there and campaigned and won. And, you know, he was very much focused on the local issues and sort of in a very sort of calm, measured way, challenging some of that, frankly, nonsense and lies that George Galloway came out with, and managed to kind of turn the tide.
Yeah, yeah. And Galloway didn't even turn up for the count.
He didn't.
Indefatigable George Galloway was conspicuous by his absence. Now, here's a question just briefly about Scotland. Something reasonably seismic happened in Scotland. Again, I watched that starting to happen sort of firsthand this week. I was in the constituency of Coatbridge in Lanarkshire, which is about 20, 25 minutes drive from Glasgow. And I met a fair number of people who'd come away from voting Labour after a lifetime of voting Labour in many cases, voted SNP and then had witnessed the problems that have afflicted the SNP government in Holyrood and decided to start voting Labour again. And they were quite umphy in their explanation of that. There was quite a lot of righteous outrage. And as a consequence, Labour has taken a lot of seats held by the SNP, mm-hmm. particularly in that kind of central belt of Scotland, Pippa.
Yeah, I mean, Labour had just two seats in Scotland before the election. And, you know, the SNP has been the dominant party for, you know, more than a decade up there. And what I think has been really interesting is its combination of factors this time. First of all, the fall of Nicola Sturgeon and the collapse of the leadership of the Scottish National Party. John Swinney, formerly Sturgeon's deputy, sort of came in as a sort of a safe pair of hands, trying to sort of like keep things stable and steady. He's the first minister up there, but that wasn't enough. Secondly was the UK backdrop, that actually for the first time in a very long time, there was a real chance, people in Scotland felt, of voting at a Westminster election and getting rid of the Tories. And in most bits of Scotland, that was a very strong motivating factor, whatever you thought about independence. And then the third aspect of it is that the constitutional question just was not as present or at the forefront in the way that it has been in previous elections, because independence in Scotland has not felt further away since the run-up to the 2014 referendum. It's not been an urgent issue. It's not one which John Swinney even has prioritised. One of his first moves when he came in with his cabinet up in Holyrood was to abolish the post of independence minister and make it clear that his focus was going to be on the cost of living and the impact of public services on people's lives. And I think that ultimately all of those factors meant that when people voted in Scotland, they thought, who's going to best represent us? And they decided that it was going to be Labour rather than the SNP.
Yeah, I picked up a certain relief among some people in Scotland about the sort of tentative return of what they felt was politics as usual. It did feel like that. Anyway, we are going to talk after the break about the fall of a great number of so-called Tory big beasts. So let's pause here for a moment.
Wer die Finanzen eines Unternehmens managt, ist oft beschäftigt. Sehr beschäftigt. Sehr, sehr, sehr beschäftigt. Konto ist das All-in-One-Geschäftskonto, um Ihr Unternehmen zu managen. Egal, ob Sie selbstständig sind oder die Finanzabteilung eines mittleren Unternehmens leiten. Mit Konto erledigen Sie alles in einer App. Geschäftskonto schnell eröffnet? Erledigt. Ausgabenmanagement? Erledigt. Buchhaltung und Reporting? Erledigt. Konto. Das Geschäftskonto, das zu Ihnen passt.
Welcome back. We are going to talk about one of the most entertaining aspects of yesterday night, for those who stayed up long enough to see them all fall, which was the defenestration of quite a few senior Conservatives. Liz Truss, Grant Shapps, Penny Mordaunt, Jacob Rees-Mogg, Liam Fox, Brexit hardman, self-styled MP for Wickham, formerly Steve Baker. a lot of them. What's that done, as far as you understand it, to what remains of the Parliamentary Conservative Party and its sense of its own safety?
Well, it's whittled down the list of potential leadership contenders, I tell you that. I mean, there's quite a few people, I think, including Steve Baker, who rather audaciously just before the election declared himself open for the leadership when he was facing what we knew was going to be a very tough constituency fight. But yes, so the runners and riders list is that much smaller today than it was yesterday.
By an amazing fluke, it's like the butterfly effect. What happened in Godalming and Ash, which means that Jeremy Hunt, a One Nation Tory, who everyone thought was going to lose his seat, is sort of in contention, possibly to be the next Conservative leader, because the Green Party in Godalming and Ash wanted to stand down in favour of the Liberal Democrats, and the National Green Party imposed a candidate. And as a consequence, Jeremy Hunt survived. So he's still there, unexpectedly.
I mean, he did work that constituency very hard, didn't he?
And spent a lot of his own money.
Yeah. Well, and he was barely out on the national campaign. In fact, we went down to spend some time with him to write a story about the campaign. I was taken to knock on a few doors, and the first three houses we got to were all Conservatives who said, yes, Jeremy, don't worry, I don't like the party nationally anymore, but I'm going to back you. And he turned around to me and said, you know what, I have to be honest with you, this is not representative of the doors that we're knocking. Let's keep going until we find someone that's not voting for me. And of course, luckily for him, the next house wasn't. But I thought that was very fair.
He's a fair guy, isn't he?
Keep going, Kieran. The Tory leadership field, potentially.
Well, look, I mean, the Tory leadership field, I think now you're looking at Kemi Badenoch, obviously. You're looking at Priti Patel, Tom Tugendhat. You know, you still have possibly Jeremy Hunt, as you mentioned. You know, you still have enough big beasts around to make up quite an interesting contest.
You haven't mentioned Suella Braverman.
I don't think she's got a chance. I'm going to be honest with you.
That she won't stand, do you think?
No, she'll stand. I assume she'll stand. I think she is a much weaker candidate than many outside of Westminster realise. She's made herself quite unpopular with a lot of Tory MPs, and she's made a series of botched interventions after she left government, after she kind of quit spectacularly from her job as Home Secretary. And I think she's put the back up backs up of a lot of Tory MPs. But look, what are the
there's another question there. What about reborn Tory populist Robert Jenrick?
Well, he would be, if I was a betting woman, and clearly I'm not, then I would put money on him. I mean, I think actually that his sort of like him recasting himself, rebranding himself as being further to the right than he had been for the rest of his political career when he quit as immigration minister was primarily, if not solely designed to make himself more presentable to the Tory membership. Because, of course, the last two candidates selected by MPs go to the Tory membership. And generally what's happened is that the one of those two who's on the right of the party gets the party membership's backing. It happened with Liz Truss, it happened with Boris Johnson, it's happened previously. And so I think that's what that was about. So I think there'll be a fight on the right of the party between Kemi Badenoch and Robert Jenrick to be that candidate. And there'll be a fight in the centre of the party between Tom Tugendhat and Vicky Atkins, the health secretary, to be the candidate on that wing of the party.
And then Priti Patel, I think, quite possibly coming through the middle. I think, you know, you really shouldn't underestimate her. She's kind of remade her reputation after leaving government, and having been seen as a figure very much of the right of the party, is now seen as someone who can straddle both wings. So I wouldn't be at all surprised to see her in the final two.
Let's talk about the Lib Dems. As I said a moment ago, the Lib Dems won 71 seats. And again, there's a sort of interesting, quite complex bit of politics here, because a lot of people think that for as long as Jeremy Corbyn was the Labour Party leader, it was not safe for hitherto Conservative voters in the southeast and southwest of England to risk voting for the Lib Dems. But one of the corollaries, the knock-on effects of Keir Starmer's leadership, is they felt they could do that. And we all know what happened. Again, this is a story I followed really closely. So I spent a lot of time, partly because it's very nice, it has nice artisan coffee shops and all that stuff. Nice place to have lunch.
Don't you live down there, John, as well?
No, I live in the... I was talking about Surrey there.
Oh, okay, sorry.
So I spent a lot of time in Guildford and Woking and Godalming, which you just mentioned a moment ago, and over the county line in Aldershot, where against considerable odds, the Labour Party took that seat, the former home of the British Army, from the Conservatives. And then there's the South West, Kieran, as you mentioned. There was a lot of controversy where I live about tactical voting, but the Lib Dems did really well. They sort of restored their traditional southwestern heartland. They've done really well, let's be honest, haven't they?
They've done really well. I mean, when you consider that their record to date was under Charles Kennedy's leadership in 2005, when they took 62 seats, and they're currently on 71. I mean, that is massive. I mean, it didn't used to be hard for us to know the names of every single Lib Dem MP in this place. There were sort of around about a dozen of them. And now we're going to have to get swatting to work out, you know, to find out who they all are.
No, less than that at one stage. I had a cover of G2. I wrote a story called How You Can Fit the Lib Dems in a Mazda Bongo.
Well, there you go. It might be a bit cosy, though. How big is a Mazda Bongo? I don't know.
I think it was 8 or 9.
Oh, well, there you go then. Maybe about that. But they also, as you say, right across the country, they also have taken down a few big beasts themselves, 4 cabinet ministers, Julian Keegan and so on. And a very sort of symbolic set of results for me was that they denied the Tory success in constituencies previously held by 3 former prime ministers, Theresa May's seat, David Cameron's seat and Boris Johnson's seats. These were all regarded at the time they were held by those former prime ministers as very safe Tory seats. Safe no more. The Lib Dem, the yellow peril, as the Tories sometimes call them, have come in, bungee jumped and canoed and paddleboarded their way in and taken those seats.
Let's just talk very quickly about the Green Party. The Green Party went into this election defending one seat, Brighton Pavilion, which had been held by Caroline Lucas. She was standing down. Sian Berry took over. Sian Berry won that seat. Carla Denyer, the co-leader of the Green Party, took the new seat of Bristol Central from Thangham Debonair, a very high-flying Labour politician. And the Green Party has also won 2 other seats. One, North Herefordshire, which is sort of out in apple-growing land. I used to live near there once. And the other one is Waveney.
I think the interesting thing about these seats is that 2 of them... obviously the one that they held, but they were up against Labour. And then obviously there was Bristol Central one, which was taken from Labour's Thangham Debonair. And the other 2 are Tory seats. And the complexions are very different. You know, there's 2 that are very urban, very progressive. And there's 2 which are rural, small villages, you know, issues around nature and farming and all those sorts of things. And I think that's a really interesting sort of microcosm of what the Green coalition is. It came second in quite a lot of seats to the Conservatives as well. That shows, I think, the breadth of the Green coalition. But I've always felt that the more scrutiny that they come under, the more seats that they have, that the sort of the tensions that exist in that coalition will become more evident, because no one's quite sure, beyond obviously, you know, commitment to climate and nature, what the Greens stand for, because they actually within that grouping, there's quite a lot of different views on things.
Oh, all sorts. Yeah, completely. I mean, a new strand to the Green Party's politics are sort of refugee Corbynites, people on the left of politics who got brassed off with life in Keir Starmer's Labour Party and have joined in reasonably visible numbers the Green Party, talking of whom Jeremy Corbyn is now, I think I'm right in saying, the father of the house, the oldest MP. Oh, is he not? I read that overnight.
Well, actually, he's not necessarily going to be father of the house. I think we need to establish this, because on the 16th of June 1983, a series of MPs queued up to take the oath of allegiance. And there was a newly elected Tory MP called Edward Lee, who still sits in the House of Commons, who is a few places ahead of the new Labour MP at that time, Jeremy Corbyn. It was no issue up until this moment, because of course the father of the house is decided on who is based on who's been in the Commons for longest, and given they both came in at the same election, whoever was further forward in the queue when it came to signing in this case probably just by a matter of minutes, will be father of the house.
Sometimes this place is mad.
But we are expecting Diane Abbott.
That's very impressive, Pippa. I want you on my lobby.
But we are expecting Diane Abbott to be the mother of the house. And I could be wrong on Edward Lee anyway, so I wouldn't take that as gospel.
That's good, isn't it? That's a good thing. That's a good thing. Now, here's a question. I mean, we haven't mentioned in the midst of that somewhat fascinatingly arcane conversation about Jeremy Corbyn and Edward Lee. The point is that Jeremy Corbyn ran against his former party as an independent in Islington North, and he won.
Yeah, I think you always knew it was going to be close. There was an interesting poll, wasn't there, during the campaign, which I think that Corbyn's own supporters paid for, which suddenly suggested that the Labour Party was going to win it quite easily. And obviously they didn't. In fact, Corbyn's majority was really convincing. Lots of senior Labour people have been saying, and maybe this is why the poll slightly misled us, that people said, oh yes, I'm going to vote Labour, and then tick the box that said Jeremy Corbyn because they thought he was still the Labour candidate. Mm. So I wonder whether there was just a lot of people who wanted to vote Labour, wanted a Labour MP, and assumed that he was the guy.
Either way, he's still there and he'll be glaring.
That's going to be an interesting relationship to watch, isn't it?
Very entertaining prospect. Right, just to finish, can we just talk about what the next few days and weeks hold, which is going to be a fascinating thing, obviously. When are we going to find out the exact membership of the new cabinet?
It's actually happening as we speak. We've already had each of the shadow cabinet ministers parading up Downing Street one by one into the Black Door, and they started announcing them. Our understanding is that everybody who was in the shadow cabinet will basically be transferred across to their corresponding role in government. And already we've had Angela Rayner announced as Deputy Prime Minister and Levelling Up Minister, and Rachel Reeves announced as Britain's first female Chancellor, and we're expecting the rest to follow.
It's worth pointing out, I wrote a piece about this the other week, I'd just like to say this, and the Labour Party made no attempt to sort of, you know, make any sort of song and dance and try and attract votes on this basis, but it is really interesting that 46%, an estimated 46% of the new cabinet are from working class backgrounds, and it's the most state educated cabinet since 1945. And that's not just symbolic, right? That has a political aspect. It's a sort of changing of the guard, and we're out of the grouse moors and Eton, at least for a long time. It's an interesting
change. It is really
change,
different. It is going to feel very different. And these are people who've not come through the usual Westminster routes, and you can sense it. Interestingly, it's one of the reasons I think that the Labour Party has been cautious for a long time, because a lot of these people don't feel naturally that they belong at the top of this system. And maybe that's now they'll start loosening up now that they are actually at the top of this system. But it is one of the things that I think has made them all so uptight, that they're not born to it. They don't feel like they're born to it in the way that a Boris Johnson is.
I think it's just a really, really interesting political change. It's personified most of all, arguably, by Angela Rayner, obviously. But the same thing applies to Wes Streeting, Pat McFadden, Steve Reid, Starmer himself. And I think tonally, it does fit with when Starmer made his speech on outside Downing Street today. And he was talking, really, he was talking about his version of the Just About Managing. And he used the phrase working class. He used that term, right? So I think that kind of changing of the guard is going to be built into the way this government presents itself. Right. Last question of all. There's a right din going on there. What are people doing?
Yeah, we're just having a lot of fun. You know, we all love an election.
Everyone's got a bit delirious. They've been up
too much sugar.
It's
too much sugar.
Policy-wise, what are we expecting in short order to rear its head as far as the new government's programme is concerned? You've got about 2 minutes to answer that, and then we're all out of here.
Well, I'll go first with the foreign aspect of it very quickly, because, of course, general election campaigns, foreign policy rarely gets a mention. It did a bit on Palestine, but beyond that, hardly at all. And we think David Lammy is going to be, you know, start focusing very quickly on relationship with China, obviously Ukraine. I think we'll expect the Defence Secretary John Healey to head out there very soon. And I will be going next week to the NATO summit in Washington with Keir Starmer. And I'm imagining that the new Labour number 10 will be very keen for him to have his first bilat with Joe Biden, who may or may not end up being the Democratic candidate or indeed the next president. But nevertheless, it is our, you know, one of our most important relationships. So there'll be a lot of focus in the very early days on international relations.
OK, Kieran, you're going to take the domestic angle here.
Yeah, just one thing, planning. It's going to come, and it's going to come soon.
Which means housing.
Housing.
It's all about growth.
But also infrastructure. You know, there's going to be a big review of the entire planning system. I've been told the name of one former Tory, senior Tory, who's going to be quite involved in that. So that's going to be an interesting one to watch. If you read The Guardian, and probably on Saturday, then you might just find out who that is and what's going to happen.
Right, exciting times. Lots for journalists to get their teeth into. We are in a new era, and we haven't said that for a very, very long time. Thank you both for joining us. We share the same sort of delirious, sleep-deprived mental state. I thought we all did quite well, really, so thank you.
We're still standing, just about. Offer some more cupcakes now.
Thank you out there for listening as you eat custard creams and drink cans of Coke and try and stay awake similarly. I'm sure there are lots of people listening in a similar state of sort of mental disorientation. I hope you enjoyed today's episode in that context. If you did, make sure you subscribe to Politics Weekly UK. Pippa and Kieran will be back on Monday for another episode of Politics Weekly Westminster. I'm having a week off, and then I'm back the week after that. Right now, we are all off to see our nearest, dearest, friends, family, and get some sleep. This episode was produced by Frankie Toby. The music is by Axel Cacoutier, and the executive producers are Maz Ebtahaj and Nicole Jackson.
This is The Guardian.